My name is Jim Mogensen, community activist. I'm an active member of the Episcopal Church, both at the local, regional, and sometimes national level, and have been with the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice, Racial Economic Justice Task Force, since its earliest formations in the early 1990s.
I'm Mary Browning, part of Church of the Good Shepherd, UCC, and I knew about ICPJ. Other people at our church were active, but I didn't get really involved until probably 95.
So the earliest formation of the Racial and Economic Justice Task Force that people can remember is that it was triggered by a speaker at one of ICPJ's annual meetings in the early 1990s. We believe it was Jack Nelson Palmar. And so there was the initial formation to work on issues of racial and economic justice. And a number of the early members of that committee included myself, Jim Mogensen, Mary Browning, the Reverend Susan McGarry, who is an Episcopal priest who no longer lives in Ann Arbor, left about 3 years ago. Richard Garland, who had been a activist in the Black Action Movement at the University of Michigan in the 1970s, was a member of the Second Baptist Church, and was the founder and inspiration behind Second Baptist Martin Luther King Jr. Day Walk that was started when they were actively working on first creating the federal holiday for the Martin Luther King Day. There was also the late Barbara Weichs, who was from St. Thomas Roman Catholic Church.
Kathy Neufeld Dunn, who was pastor at Shalom and has since moved to Kansas. Paul Lambert. Ann, was it Hewitt? Ann, I just remember Ann. She was in her 80s, had been an activist from Mississippi, as I recall, and was something of a force of nature. Michael Apple.
And so this early group had formed, and what we call welfare change, but most people call welfare reform, was passed in 1996. And we had been not exactly sure how we made the connection, but we made connection with women from the Welfare Rights Union. And that was very critical because they were involved early on. I remember a march from Detroit to Lansing that I went on with the women from the Welfare Rights Union. And so that helped us as we decided to work on the welfare simulation. It was a way of educating people about what people who were had to follow the rules of welfare reform, what they had to go through. And so that was kind of the origins of the welfare simulations. And it was very important, we believe, that we included the women from the Welfare Rights Union as the leaders in that, as opposed to having us be the leadership. And that continues to this day. That's been a real key component of, I believe, both the success of that and helping us create those and understand what the rules are.
When we first started, we got a hold of the simulation from a welfare rights group in Missouri. And I remember there was a session where we practiced how it was, how it was supposed to go. I am not one who really likes role play, and I took care of the kids that came along with all these participants. So I never did practice it. And we needed, 18 to 22 volunteers each time to put it on. And Kathy Neufeld Dunn started out by being the person who got those people. And she was going to be out of town for one of them, and I was still working, so the ones that I couldn't always go to them if they were daytime ones, but I got to some because I had fairly flexible hours. Anyway, she said, would I you know, get the people. And I said, sure. And in doing so, made up a chart and, you know, with addresses and phone numbers, et cetera. And when Kathy saw my chart, she said, well, you're all organized. Why don't you just keep doing that? And so I have done that since, ever since. That's been my job. And it's sort of expanded because each time we do it, we have to redo all the packets for participants and volunteers, and that got rolled into my job. And when the office moved from Memorial Christian, all the packets went, you know, on the move, and they decided that I think they were being stored in the basement at on Broadway there and were getting a little damp. And I was asked if I knew who might keep that in their basement, and I'm thinking, oh, if I have to redo these things, I don't want them in somebody else's house. And so we have them in my basement now. But we have a long list, over 100, 150 people, who are, you know, are notified when we're going to do one and find out who can do it that day and who's available. And sometimes it's a little worrisome whether we're going to have enough people, but we've always had enough people. It's amazing how impactful it is, even for people who have lived on welfare. I mean, they will say, well, we knew all this, but they also say that it's a good good way of showing what it's like. There's always people who say, why don't you do this and why don't you do that? And usually it's a good question, and the answer is usually you can only do so much in 4 15-minute weeks. Two things that have stuck with me early on. We did it for a group of churches or congregations, and a member of our congregation participated and was in tears by the end of it. And so I asked her later if she would like to be on the other side, because she said, I never want to do that again. And I said, well, how about being a volunteer then? And, you know, just be part of the community resources. And she said, I never want to be near that again. And I remember we did it for a WIC conference. And we were kind of worried about that one because, one, we figured the people who work for WIC should know all this already. And two, it was a conference. We were scheduled for, you know, an hour and a half before lunch, and then an hour and a half for the discussion after lunch on the Friday. And that was the last session, the after lunch one. And we figured everyone's going to go home. You know, they're going to run through the simulation and then they're going to leave. And we're never going to have the discussion. But almost everybody came back. And one of the women commented that earlier in the conference, they had been told in some session that they should thank the clients for coming in for their appointment. And she said, I figured, why are we thanking them for coming to an appointment? We're doing this for them. You know, they should be thanking us, if anything. And she said, after going through the simulation, she realized how hard it was for people to get to appointments, and that, yes, it did make sense to thank them for coming in. So I've always thought, okay, you know, even if people are supposed to know about this, many don't. And secondly, people do learn things from it.
And I've also found that because of the way the simulation is structured, it triggers an aha moment that people have from real life. So even though the simulation itself all uses the play money and has the various, you know, artificial components to it, people relate to it as it relates to real life. So we tried to be very careful because there was a point in which we had a lot of people who were at the School of Social Work, And we don't ask what people's history is before they engage in these simulations. And it can, you know, bring back traumatic memories. And so we were always very careful to monitor that, to give people space to have those kind of protections in place so that if that happened, they would be able to leave if they needed to leave and have support and not just be there by themselves. Because we did find that was really helpful. That was the main aspect of it. It seems, when you first look at it, like it wouldn't have that effect, but it does, because it, as Mary is relating, it you know, people relate it to their, you know, real life experiences. So that was the 1995, 1996. We had a brief thing. We did the Stand for Children project. That essentially was a small project involved filling probably 5 or 6 buses and getting people to Washington, D.C. And then right in that 1995-1996 period, the Ku Klux Klan came to Ann Arbor and held a rally at City Hall. And there are people who were there to protest the ideology of the Ku Klux Klan. And what ended up happening was things got out of control. I do not believe I was at that rally, but I did see pictures. And essentially, you had peaceful protesters and less peaceful protesters all in one spot. And it was just kind of a mess. And so we decided that if the Klan were to come again, we were going to have to design a new way of structuring that.
And they did say that they would be back.
They said that they would be back, and so we decided to do some preparation. And in fact, they did come back in 1998. And so the Racial and Economic Justice Task Force says, well, here we are. We've got they're coming back. We need to come up with something. And so what was designed was to have a space at Wheeler Park, which is one of the city parks, maybe a mile away from City Hall, where people who were interested in being in a safe place to gather and to not have to worry about having to deal with violence could be and demonstrate their support in a safe space. There was also going to be people who were going to go to City Hall, and so people were trained as part of the peace teams to try to reduce violence. And ICPJ and the community members working on this coordinated with the police to say, this is what we intend to do, to be there, not so much to protect the Klan, but to reduce violence. And so there was the city of Ann Arbor put up a fence around City Hall. And when you look at the pictures, there's the folks who are the peace team members who have bright yellow shirts trying to reduce violence. And essentially the anti-Klan, less peaceful protesters engaged in a battle, as it were, with the peaceful protesters. I was not one of the folks who was down there. There was concern that if I had my walker and I have mobility issues, and that it could be used as a weapon. So I found myself overseeing all of this up in the Human Rights Office. There's an office building catty corner to the Ann Arbor City Hall. And so Julie Steiner, who was then the staff person for the Human Rights Office, and I were up there trying to help people understand what was happening as all of this was developing. So we had all the folks who were over at the Wheeler Park, and then we had this small subset of people who were engaged in this very intense situation down by
protecting
City
the
Hall.
Fence.
Yes, it seemed as if it was protecting the fence and trying to disengage that. So this was a very powerful, but the main reason for bringing up in this context was lots of people don't know that whole initiative came out of the Racial and Economic Justice Task Force. And then following that activity, the peace teams kind of spun off on their own. As people and a lot of folks who were more in the peace part of the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice took ownership of the peace teams and then the ongoing formation of those teams.
Sherry Wander wasn't Sherry one of our main trainers? And Sherry is still active in what was called Michigan Peace Teams with Father, what's his name?
Peter Doherty.
And which has offices in Lansing. And they changed their name last year. And at the moment, I can't tell you what it is. But they have had peace teams at collegiate things, and they've sent people to Israel and Pakistan and Palestine and have done a whole lot of different things. But that's, and that I think existed before, that's Sherry had the training from that. But there were other events in Ann Arbor that then people were called upon if you wanted to help out, just to be there to try to neutralize some things. I remember I was on the fence line, and before we actually got to the fence, when we were just sort of mingling with the crowd, I remember there were a couple of young teenage boys who had rocks and bottles ready to throw. And I remember trying to talk to them about the fact that this could land them in juvenile detention. Oh, I can do juvie. And I said, it's not doing juvie that's the problem. It's the record that you take with you for the rest of your life, et cetera. I didn't see them throw anything, but I'm not sure that I suspect that my lecture didn't probably make much of a difference in their lives. But I tried, and it was a very emotional afternoon.
So following those major activities that we've just been talking about, in July of 1998, the Racial and Economic Justice Task Force was again seeing what issues were out there. And two things had come up. And the first was Niall Harper, who was a retired Presbyterian minister, came to the Racial and Economic Justice Task Force to encourage us to help him form what finally became Religious Action for Affordable Housing. And in fact, at that REJ, the Racial Economic Justice Task Force meeting, was when the naming actually happened. That was our process, was to actually engage this. And one of the things that we said is it's very important that the members of the Racial Economic Justice Task Force not be in leadership positions at Religious Action for Affordable Housing. Well, that didn't work out so well, because all of those folks have been officers of Religious Action for Affordable Housing. But at that moment, the determinant would say, "Okay, we're going to move forward on trying to get a group together." Niall had written a book where he had surveyed throughout the country other affordable housing initiatives and faith-based initiatives. And we made a very intentional decision not to create another nonprofit that would try to create affordable housing. We already had the Avalon Housing, which came out of the Shelter Association, and we knew that you get involved in a project and it kind of takes over, and if it doesn't work, then everything falls apart. So we very intentionally decided what we would do is that we would form a group that would raise money to support those other organizations, other nonprofits that were actually creating and making that happen, and mobilize resources within the religious community to make that happen. So then another initiative that was happening at the same time was the Washtenaw Coalition for a Living Wage, which was a group that was formed to work on having local municipalities pass ordinances that would require any contractors working for those municipalities to have what we then called a living wage. And we spent a lot of time trying to figure out exactly what a living wage was. But we knew it was more than the minimum wage, but not as much as it actually cost to actually be a living wage. Well, we did the best to be bold. And so one of the good things about that was that we decided to, let me back up. So the Racial and Economic Justice Task Force decided to have a clergy breakfast. And because we had both of these initiatives, and this was on September 9th, 1998, it had two components. One was relating to the Religious Action for Affordable Housing, and the other was relating to the Living Wage campaign. And I had worked on affordable housing in another context, but I felt very strongly that we should connect in with the Living Wage campaign. So another member of the community, Bishop Jesse DeWitt, who was a very well-known and longtime activist on faith-labor relations, working at the national level, he's a retired United Methodist bishop, he and I worked on being the faith coordinators for the Washtenaw Coalition for a Living Wage. And we also had a truly dream team as in Washtenaw County. We had the labor organizations, the AFL-CIO, Huron Valley Labor Council. Fred Weigel was a longtime president of that group. And we had David Reynolds, who is a academic, and one of his specialties is living wage ordinances. So he had all of the detailed research that we needed. Rick McHugh was a lawyer who worked on labor law, so was able to help us actually create the ordinances, create model ordinances, so that it didn't get just sort of lost in the attorney's office, which sometimes happens when you try to get municipal ordinances passed. And one of the brilliant parts about it, that it was an ordinance, which is different than a resolution for, you know, a city council policy, because oftentimes policies are passed and then the administrative structures don't actually implement those resolutions, particularly over long periods of time. So having that team of having both the organized labor, some of the academics and the practical folks who were able to help, Jesse and I worked on getting a clergy letter together as part of that. And both Jesse and I worked relentlessly to get people to sign that letter. I'm a member of the Episcopal Church, and so I, you know, got essentially all the Episcopal clergy in Ann Arbor and the surrounding area to sign a support letter for the ordinance. He was in the United Methodist Church, so he got the folks there. And then we also then broadened it to other folks in the community who weren't part of those. But as of February 2000, we had 47 clergy who had signed that letter that was presented to City Council. So that was one of those things where we were able to kind of make those connections and begin to have the conversation about how churches themselves treat their workers. Are the administrative support service people in the various congregations being paid a living wage? Oftentimes that's not the case, and this initiative for the ordinance had a lot of congregations thinking through those issues and trying to put in their own congregational policies that would do that. And in fact, the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice did some thinking about that to make sure that their staff people, that some of those things were a part of the consideration. And we were able to, through this work, we were able to get the City of Ypsilanti, the City of Ann Arbor, Washtenaw County, the Road Commission, and a number of other local communities to sign on and have these ordinances in place. And they were set up they were indexed for inflation. So they actually continued to go up. And as I say, they were part of the ordinance. And so the city structures had to continually do this. And for the most part, there hadn't been too much change. Those ordinances were crafted in a way that recognized the impact on human service nonprofits. We had done that study and done that survey to engage that issue. But occasionally, if a nonprofit was having some difficulties, they would come up and say, well, it's all because of the, you know, the living wage ordinance and these things. But it was only happening. We actually did, in fact, have nonprofit organizations that themselves signed on a support letter, human service organizations that signed a support letter saying that they wanted to have a living wage ordinance so that they would have a reason that they had to, in fact, increase the pay because they felt their employees needed to have that, but it was difficult oftentimes at board level to have that happen.
The fact that Toby Hannah Davies and her husband gave us $50,000 with the stipulation that we had to triple that. And they gave that to us, and they also gave money to ICPJ, but I don't know the amount. When they moved to Kalamazoo, they sold their house in Ann Arbor, they bought a house in Kalamazoo, and the difference, the money that, you know, they made off of that sale and that didn't need to use for buying in Kalamazoo, they split between RA and ICPJ, which not many people would do. And we have continued. We have probably raised $550,000 by now in our different campaigns cumulatively. It's always interesting. Every congregation is different in terms of how you can approach them, what kind of support they give. It is very hard to get into a congregation to get money for something that they haven't been giving to because they have, you know, they have what they've done and they don't want to give up anything and they don't really want to add to it. One of our board members the other day said that she had been trying to talk to a particular pastor, and she said, I'm beginning to feel like I'm stalking him. And so she said, I'm going to give it a rest for a while. And I said, well, I was having the same feeling with the person I was trying to get a hold of. You know, I kept leaving messages, and I would email him, and nothing. And he finally did answer a very nice email explaining, you know, what was going on at the church and in his life, and he would be happy to talk to me in August. And I said, fine. August is good. But it is. It takes a lot of time. And Niall Harper was good at that. And I've always had this sense, although we have some more people on the board now that I think are maybe a little savvier than we were at the beginning, but I've always had the sense that the board of RA is made up of people who are passionate about affordable housing, but not necessarily skilled at what we need to do. There were times when Niall was a little bit more authoritarian than we wanted, and we would give him a hard time. But he really did have a gift of getting people involved and getting congregations involved, and we've missed that when he moved.
So the makeup of this organization has always been 100% volunteer?
Yes. There is no paid staff. So the money, and there's no office. We get our mail courtesy of St. Andrew's Episcopal Church here in town, and I guess our spare bedroom is as much office as any. Whoever's president sort of has it in their off, you know. So the money that we raise, there, you know, we do have some organizational expenses, but basically the money we raise goes to affordable housing.
And one of the important things was that Jesse DeWitt, a retired United Methodist bishop, early on decided that if we were going to raise large sums of money, that we should talk with the Ann Arbor Community Foundation so that people would not be worried about where the money was going. when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars, there needed to be some kind of internal control. And at the time, the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice didn't have quite that level of internal control and fees that were going to work. And so he negotiated with them that we would deposit the money with them and they would not charge us any fees. So it was a somewhat unusual arrangement.
We don't get any interest, but neither do we have to pay any fees. And it's not invested like most of the money is, so that it doesn't go up and down. What we put in there, we know is there. And since then, there's four or five groups that now have that arrangement. But I think we might have been the first, or if not the first, only the second, that did that with them. So that's, and that has worked well.
So big projects looming for Ron?
We're hoping to finish up a 3-year campaign by the end of May, which is when our annual meeting is. And this campaign was $50,000 for Avalon working with Fuse, which was, oh, how do you explain that simply? Catholic Social Services got a grant from a federal group, not a governmental group, but there were four grants, one to Connecticut, one to Los Angeles, one to San Francisco, and one to Washtenaw County, which is impressive when you think how that was done, to find housing. They worked with, I think, about 15 different agencies. And the theory is to find housing for those people who are chronically homeless and using emergency hospitalization and emergency room more than anybody else in the county. So they zeroed in on those 100 people with the theory that if you get them housed, you can get them into regular medical treatment. You can eliminate all the emergency service, at least a lot of the emergency services and hospitalizations. And each of the agencies that were involved in this had to raise matching funds. And so our $50,000 was in aid of Avalon's matching funds. Also $25,000 to MAP, Michigan Ability Partners, which needed supportive services for one of their places called Whispering Creek. And the other was for what had been MPRI, Michigan Prisoner Reentry Initiative, and is now called Washtenaw Prisoner Initiative, or not Washtenaw Prisoner Program. And again, supportive services for those returning citizens who had more than the usual problems. So we are, if we get nothing more in on our capital campaign between now and the end of May, we'll be about $5,000 short of our 3-year commitment. And we have enough in our organizational money comes from dues and people who give who don't designate undesignated funds. Anything that comes in for the capital campaign goes directly to the capital campaign. So we probably have enough in our checkbook that we could cover that $5,000. We're hoping we're still getting some more in, but so we're close. Getting there.
One of the challenges of the living wage ordinance campaign is maintaining an ongoing oversight role. So people were very active in the beginning, and then as the ordinances were passed, monitoring what the municipalities are doing was to some degree quite a challenge because the group that had formed essentially dissipated. And so it took, and I, as a person who watched a lot of city council activities, would watch as these things would develop. and act, but I, you know, but essentially, you know, there was no ongoing work. So the Racial Economic Justice Task Force, I like to think of the Racial Economic Justice Task Force for ICBJ as being the pilot light in the community, which then is able to respond when much more dramatic effects happen. But it requires, we've also found that when we have these types of activities, we'll have a lot of folks involved when something very exciting is happening. And then over time, it gets back to the core people who are willing to meet and meet on a very regular basis to be there at the time, to build those relationships that are important to have. So that when something needs to be organized, those relationships are all there already. And a core group of people who are used to doing that can help bring in people who are not ordinarily coming to these types of organizational administrative meetings. But that has been a challenge in terms of, you know, follow-up. That was 15 years ago. And some of those folks are still in town. Some people have died, and some people have moved away and are not as active. So that's been one thing I wanted to say about the Religious Action for Affordable Housing is that it was intentionally discussed and decided to focus on supported housing, which is different. You have people who are actively homeless in tent cities, the shelter, that kind of housing. And then you have Habitat for Humanity, which is building home ownership type activities. So this was oftentimes a challenge going into congregations. Habitat for Humanity has a great model, which allows congregations to engage the entire parish in an exciting activity in terms of building a house. But there was a strong infrastructure in place for Habitat for Humanity. So over the times, we haven't actually had a separate campaign to help support Habitat for Humanity. We've been helping the other nonprofits who are doing more of the supportive housing work. So that has been the focus over long periods of time, is to maintain that, even though when there was less building of that, when they had the housing crash in 2008, some of that activity changed in the profile on how that was all happening since we first formed. And
we really want to see more units of housing. And 3 years ago, when we, you know, checked with agencies on what they were doing and what they needed, they all said, there's no way we can build anything at this point or buy units. We just don't have the funding. We don't have, you know, and what we have to offer is not huge money. But they all needed help with the supportive services, because that too, the funding of that was changing in terms of what HUD would do and all these things. And some of them were, MAP especially at that point, desperately needed, so that when we gave them the first $25,000 that we raised on that 3-year campaign, because they just didn't have the funds for the support services. So we're hoping someday to again get more units, but meanwhile, you know, whatever works.
And it's also been one of those situations where we've been able to identify neighbors that live in a neighborhood. And so when people are building affordable housing, there is often a lot of pushback from local neighbors. And in fact, our first at Carrot Way out at the Food Gatherers site, Bishop DeWitt was actually living out in that neighborhood. And so it was be able to a voice that was both a neighbor and an advocate for supported housing. And so we've also been able, since we're not a nonprofit who is looking for housing funding, and independent of that, we also have the ability to engage in advocacy activity that folks who are trying to get funding are less likely to feel comfortable doing. And so providing some extra support in that way. And it really is an extraordinary thing when the nonprofit Enterprise for Work folks look at us and say, okay, you're a 15-year-old organization and you don't have any paid staff, but oh, wait, you've raised over $500,000. How did you do that? We're sometimes amazed at how that exactly happened over time, but it just comes from just relentlessly not giving up and doing the best we can to use our relationships in the community to convince people that this is a useful thing. And we've also found that the nonprofit providers have found that this is very helpful to have our large pledge as part of their proposals. So they can say, even though we don't have all of the money raised yet, when they give their proposals, they can say, Religious Action Affordable Housing has pledged $50,000, which is not something that they can do when they're trying to decide whether they can get individual contributions from individual congregations, because a lot of the individual congregations that we interact with also provide direct support to some of the same housing nonprofits that we work with. And so it's oftentimes an educational opportunity to explain why it is that Religious Action for Affordable Housing makes sense, both, you know, and in terms of sort of serving as the united way, the religious united way for affordable housing, but it also has those types of benefits that may not be immediately obvious.
Well, I'll start rolling.
So it turns out that back in 1959, the city of Ann Arbor actually held a public vote on whether to have a public transportation system. And over time, it won by a majority, but not enough to make the bonding happen. So it took some time, but back in 1973, a public millage was passed from the city of Ann Arbor, and the Ann Arbor Area Transportation Authority was created.
And before that, I can remember at least three other bus companies that formed and died. Various reasons, I'm sure, on all. And I remember my kids, you know, saying, I have to take the bus, when we finally had a bus. I grew up in D.C., and you took a lot of buses, and I used to get really annoyed. What do you mean you have to take the bus? You're lucky there is a bus. You don't have to walk. But this one actually flourished.
Yes, and part of the impetus of the formation of the Ann Arbor Transportation Authority was that one of these private companies had been working with the city, and the city council was having to deal with invoices and all kinds of just endless details. And they said, we can't be doing this anymore. We need to have a separate entity. And the state had passed a law that allowed these public transportation authorities to be created. And so the decision was made to try to do this, and the millage, with the help of University of Michigan students, was passed in 1973, and AATA was created. And when they created the AATA, the main focus was the city of Ann Arbor. But early on, a number of transit experts had been put on the board of the AATA, and they recognized that over time they were going to need to have transportation possibilities in the urban core of Washtenaw County, which included both Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. So even though they had just passed the millage in Ann Arbor, they created a system and worked with all the local municipalities in the area, and somehow got Ann Arbor Township and Superior Township and the City of Ypsilanti and Ypsilanti Township and Pittsfield Township to all use their federal revenue sharing money to participate and to use that money for the local share. And so that was the impetus for having the service include not just the city of Ann Arbor, but also Ann Arbor-Ypsilanti. But over time, it was a continuing challenge to maintain this service. The service in the city of Ypsilanti was fairly inadequate. The buses would only run every hour, and the city of Ypsilanti was constantly challenged in terms of its budgets. Many people don't realize this, but the property tax millage rate is a lot higher in the city of Ypsilanti than it is in the city of Ann Arbor. If you have a $100,000 house in the city of Ann Arbor and a $100,000 house in the city of Ypsilanti, the person who lives in the city of Ypsilanti pays $2,000 more per year in property taxes than the person who lives in the city of Ann Arbor, even with all the additional millages of the parks and the libraries and everything else. And so this was a continuing problem, and it was. And finally, the city of Ypsilanti had essentially gotten to its state maximum, and it was no longer able to raise general property taxes. And so what to do? A lot of people who work at the University of Michigan and in the city of Ann Arbor and the restaurants and other places can't afford to live in the city of Ann Arbor and live east of 23. And so there was this critical problem. How are we going to figure out how to maintain this system? When we had the crash in 2008, the AATA used some of the stimulus money that was available to help support the city of Ypsilanti's contribution. But it became clear at that time that they were going to need to come up with some kind of an alternative solution. So the idea was to have a countywide authority. And the challenge with creating the countywide authority is the structure that had been in place in order to do that would have definitely severely limited the political clout of the city of Ann Arbor in this whole transportation system. And as so, the AATA went through a large process to try to figure out how to make this work, but was unable to make that, over time, make that happen. So now we have to go to Plan B. And so the idea is that the AATA would come up with its own millage, and that would be a way to get around the barrier that the city of Ypsilanti couldn't raise its taxes anymore, but it could have its citizens pay taxes to the Ann Arbor Area Transportation Authority. And so in 2014, a millage proposal was put on the ballot to make that happen. Now, in order to make that happen, there was a need to have a lot of community support. And so a group called Partners for Transit was formed by people who were actively supportive of working on this issue. In the same way that if you have, say, a library millage or some other kind of millage, the actual governmental authorities cannot advocate for a political outcome, but can have folks who were out in the community advocating on their behalf. So that was the formation. It had been a while, 5 years, even before the millage, to have a group called Partners for Transit, which is a coalition of folks who were working on this issue. And they had the Ecology Center, where a lot of the staff folks came from. The Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice was ancillarily involved. Now, one of the positive things about the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice is it has a very good contact list of people who may not be working on one particular issue, but are interested in these types of issues. And so the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice can alert people to issues that are arising in the community. So although most of the activity came out of this Partners for Transit group, the ICPJ played a critical role in getting folks to know about what was happening. And it has a lot of racial and economic justice flavor to it, because the reality is that east of US 23, incomes are lower, and there is a larger percentage of people who are African American in particular, and Latina, who live east of 23. Is the makeup of Washtenaw County. So being able to have reasonable service east of 23 is a critical component, and therefore was worthy of having the Racial and Economic Justice Task Force allow to have the transit millage as part of the things that the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice were working on. The millage was successful, and now we are working to maintain the activity relating to that. Unlike the initial Ann Arbor transportation millage in 1973, which was a perpetual millage and does not have to be renewed, now millages have to be renewed, and so in another 5 years there will be another millage campaign in order to maintain this service. And so there'll be a need to have people monitoring this, and in fact people are continuing to meet even though the transit millage campaign is over to monitor this and to build those relationships, which are so important in making these kind of things possible. You are able to have these personal relationships in place already so that people can start to work and not have to have, you know, a 4 or 5 month period where people have to start to develop relationships. You already have the relationships in place. People already know each other. And so having that type of ability that the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice provides is critical to the success of these types of programs in our community. Thank you.